Welcome to another episode of the Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes, the storytelling show that features The Clearing, where all good questions come to get asked and all good stories come to be told, and where all my guests have two things in common. They're all creative individuals and all with an interesting story to tell. There are some lovely storytelling metaphors. A clearing, a tree, a juicy storytelling exercise called 5-4-3-2-1, some alchemy, some gold, a cheeky bit of Shakespeare, and a cake. So it's all to play for. So yes, welcome to the Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we shall begin. Welcome to a very exciting and indeed scintillating episode of the Good Listening To Show, Stories of Distinction and Genius. Absolutely thrilled and delighted to have actor-manager Neil Foster in the clearing. Neil and I were at the Brisalovic Theatre School circa way back when, and just to blow a bit of extra happy smoke at you, you're an actor-manager, which is a wonderful ancient tradition. You've been at the helm of the Birmingham Stage Company for, I know, at least over 30 years. But if I may just blow this particular happy smoke, I loved researching you and actor management. This is lovely, from Wikipedia, not just about you, but about what you do. An actor manager is a leading actor who sets up their own permanent theatrical company and manages the business, sometimes taking over a theatre to perform select plays in which they usually star. It's a method of theatrical production used consistently since the 16th century. And I happen to know that that's in the company of greats like Sir Richard Burbage of the Shakespeare's Lord Chamberlain Company and the Globe Theatre. So you're an illustrious company because you're keeping going with an ancient tradition that happens most often in the United Kingdom and in America as well. So Neil Foster, you are extremely welcome to the clearing of the Good Listening To Show.
Thank you. Spotlight. Spotlight wouldn't let me put myself in Spotlight as an actor manager to start with. They didn't recognize it. No, there's no such thing. So you're ahead, Chris. You're ahead of Spotlight. Eventually, I forced them. I said, well, I'm not a director. I'm not artist director. And I'm not just a manager. I'm not a chief executive. I'm an actor who manages the company. So eventually, they recognized that
yes,
it exists.
And thank you for that wonderful word, recognised. You've done many, many, many things. You've got many a theatrical banger to your name, specialising in children's theatre, which you bring to families the world over. And I think 2018, I know you know this, but you were given an honorary professorship of Amity University in New Delhi for bringing quality theatre to children and families throughout the world.
Yeah, so I am technically a professor. So, which is why I shaved all my hair off so that I'd look the part.
Lovely. And so, Professor Neil Foster, you're extremely welcome. And we were at the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School together in 1986 to 88. I was there. I was on the two-year course. You were on the three-year course. But you sent me a photograph which reminded me to get in touch with you of us being in the front page at one of our final year productions.
Very good production.
Yes. I mentioned your theatrical bangers. You can tell us all about it, but you specialise in bringing a lot of David Walliams' stuff to the stage. But Horrible Histories is a real cut and thrust that you're doing very often of late. And you even were at the children's prom at the Royal Albert Hall, bringing Horrible Opera just a few months ago as well. Thus proving I've done some research. So how are you? How's morale? What's your story of the day, Neil?
My story of the day is that I've been working with puppets this morning for our new production of Awful Auntie, which is going out next year. I will be playing Awful Auntie, and it's my first ever year-long tour. I've never done it before because it's hard. But I decided I've reached that age when I should get out and be an actor manager and take the title role. And so I'll be playing Auntie for David Walliams next year, all year. So if you want to see Awful Auntie, it's on all year.
And some of your productions, it says coming to a car park near you soon, but you don't normally perform in car parks. Obviously, Richard III should obviously be pasted in a car park or buried under it. But normally it's theatres throughout the land, but not least your own, which is the Birmingham Stage Company.
Yes, well, Birmingham Stage Company, we were based at the Old Rep Theatre for 23 years, and then we moved to the Alex about 8 years ago. We did do car parks because during COVID, Guy Robinson, who runs Coalition Agency, had a brilliant idea. He said, given that we can't do any theatre in in the theatres. They're all closed. Let's do them in car parks. So we were the first theatre company in the country to be performing when the lockdown opened. And we were the only theatre company still performing on, I don't know whether it was Christmas Eve or New Year's Eve, up in Harrogate, because that was the time when they were shutting down by tiers.
Yes.
And we'd managed to just outmaneuver Boris as he closed down the country. So we were still performing. We were performing outdoors in my pajamas in the middle of winter to 900 cars that were sitting watching our show, Horrible Christmas, which we're still doing, up in Harrogate, I think it was, in a race course up there. So, yeah, we've done them all. We've done car parks, Sydney Opera House, Broadway, and Warwick Castle. That's the list I'm going
to
give you.
Sort of a theatrical troupe, always on the run, moving from chop house to chop house as you move, as you say, keeping it just ahead of the pandemic. Very good. So it's my great pleasure to welcome you to this show, where it's going to be a clearing a tree. There's a lovely, juicy storytelling exercise called 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. There's going to be some alchemy, some gold, a couple of random squirrels, a cheeky bit of Shakespeare, and a cake. Oh, and a golden baton as well. So it's all to play for. Yes. So let's get you on the open road then. So where is, what is a clearing for Neil Foster, actor, manager? Where do you go to get clutter-free, inspirational, and able to think?
Well, I'm very lucky that I have a place where I was born, where I still own it, even though all my family have gone, in Warwickshire, which is at the bottom of a lane. There's only four houses in the lane, and I am at the bottom of it. And it's absolute paradise, and it's where I go to feel real again. Because I like London, but I don't know if I love London. I'm not really a city person. If I go, like when we did the tour of Australia, I was always trying to get to the nearest rainforest or the botanical garden, wherever I was, and I'd spend all that time there. I'm not really, concrete and glass and pavements does very little for me as a human being. So I'm very, very lucky to have a country place where I can go and feel that I'm whole again.
So it's a country pile in Warwickshire, which is very Shakespearean, if I may say so. Is it near Stratford?
About 40 minutes from Stratford. And he often pops round shares his ideas with me. Most of his ideas are really quite rubbish these days. It's amazing how people go off, isn't it? They go off. But you know, the early stuff was good, I thought. I thought the early stuff was the best.
And you mentioned that everyone's gone from your country pile now. Is that because your parents and siblings are no longer with us? Or they just decided to leave?
Siblings are very much with us, but they're with us somewhere else. And my parents are, yes. My father wanted to be buried in the field where my house is, but his wife didn't like the idea of that. But I did. I thought it'd be quite nice to have Dad sort of just there.
Yes.
But anyway, he went up, and my mum is buried in a cemetery in Birmingham. So yeah, it's just me now and the neighbours, and luckily I've got amazing neighbours. So I go there as often as I possibly can. I do not like to be in London when it's hot.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Stop suffering with pet-related allergies when near dogs and cats. Great news, you can feel safe around pets with NasalGuard for pet lovers. NasalGuard topical gel blocks pet dander, hair, and dust mites from entering your nasal passages. Try NasalGuard for pet lovers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about NasalGuard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Dec, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Yes.
If it's hot, I want to be in the middle of countryside.
And you mentioned it's just you. I haven't seen you for about 30 years, obviously, so I don't know if you're actually married or not. And that was a bit of research I didn't manage to stumble onto.
No, I don't think that was my gift. It wasn't never, probably never on the agenda. So no, not because I'm of the persuasion that leads away from marriage in that context, just that it's not something I'm not something I'm brilliant at. So I've done it my way.
And I've done it my way. We can burst into song at that moment.
Yeah, could.
And you mentioned your father went up. I'm assuming you didn't send him off on a hot air balloon. You're talking about the sort of normal ways in which we dispatch.
He did have a hot air balloon. He was a hot air balloon pilot, you see. You've done your research. And I think it's going to be one of the things I tell you. So I'm not going to give it away just now.
Okay.
Yes, it is one of the things I was going to tell you. But yes, he did have a hot air balloon. No, what happened was... I sort of didn't feel I'd said a full goodbye at his funeral. And I said, I'd just like to say one last goodbye to my dad. And he said, he's gone through already. But let's rush round and see if you can just say your goodbye. And when I went round, he went, oh, we're too late. And there he was on fire.
Wow.
And so that's an experience I wouldn't recommend to anybody.
Yes. And how many years ago is this now, Neil?
Five. Yeah.
Yep. And your mum is...
Nearly six.
Your mother is with us? No.
No, died a long time ago. Yeah.
Remaining fosters, how many siblings?
I've got a brother and a sister, both older, and I've got lots of nieces and nephews, which is good. Some in America. God help them.
Yes.
But some people do live in America, and I feel sorry for all of them.
And you did mention earlier that you've done tours of the Australia because you've been in the Royal Opera House. Have you toured the States as well with the Birmingham Stage Company?
We only went once. We only went once. We went to Broadway with Skellig, which was a play by David Almond based on his fantastic book. And it was one of the great experiences because we opened Skellig when they opened Spider-Man. And our show cost £60,000 and Spider-Man cost $60 million. And we got better reviews, which made me feel, you know, slightly pleased with ourselves.
Yes.
That we outdid this monumental production by the woman who, of course, directed Lion King. But it wasn't as good as that.
And you have directed a lot of Roald Dahl stuff in the past. You tried to offer me a part in Big Friendly Giant Once Upon a Time, which I thank you very much for trying to do that.
Let me down again.
And yes, Michael Morpurgo, you've also done adaptations of his work too. Maybe
he's amazing. Yeah, he's a wonderful person. We're very lucky with the people we've worked with. I mean, we didn't work with Roald Dahl, although I did speak to him.
Oh, okay.
When I was 15, I decided I wanted to interview people to raise money for charity.
Yes, I remember this. This is your audience with.
That's right, because I did one at drama school with John Cleese. At that point, the Who's Who, the book that has everyone's name and addresses in it, also had all their phone numbers. I mean, you could literally call anybody because it was in the age time before celebrities. So I called this number in Great Missenden, and a man answered the phone. I said, hello, is Ronald Dahl there, please? And the voice said, no, he's not. I said, I thought this was Ronald Dahl's number. He said, no one of that name lives here. He said, there's a Roald Dahl who lives here.
Well, you're lucky.
I went, oh, yes, Mr. Roald Dahl. Can I speak to Mr. Roald Dahl? Speaking. And that was him.
And luckily he didn't put the phone down on you for not getting his name right, which is, so he didn't have that sort of ego, which is great.
No, but I said, would you let me interview at my school? And he said, no, I'm far too old, far too grumpy, and far too annoying to be interviewed by a young boy like you, but good luck. And that was it.
And it was Clifton College, wasn't it, is the old school?
It's Clifton College.
Because, yeah. By the way, I've just had a breakthrough. This has become a theatre show now as well. And the Redgrave Theatre have just offered me some dates to continue doing the live theatre show version.
Oh, wow. So I love the Redgrave. It's a great theatre.
And your audience is with, by the way, you've got a lovely, as you say, your who's who-ness and just veracity of ringing people up. You had Alan Bennett, Dame Judi Dench, Michael Frayn, Dustin Hoffman, Derek Jacobi, bangers, Jack Lemmon, Sir Ian McKellen, Prunella Scales and Donald Sinden.
Yeah, but I didn't ring them. I doorstepped them at stage doors. What I did is on one afternoon, ran from stage door to stage door, grabbing as many famous people as I could and saying, would you let me interview you in the West End? And they all went, yes. And 6 weeks later, we did the interviews. So that...
Fantastic.
That was fun.
I'd love to pick your brains about that more. Interestingly, I met Sir Ian McKellen recently because he was... I met him and I said he'd been furnished with the fact I might want to speak to him. And he gave the most fantastic answer, which involves an expletive, not at me, but he went, oh, do you mind if I don't? I'm so fucking bored about talking about myself, he said. So it's in another wave, obviously. So you've
well,
got
him. That's it. I was turned down by three people. So Anthony Hopkins, who told me at great length why he didn't want to do it, Vanessa Redgrave and Daniel Day-Lewis. They were the only three I actually said no. And you can sort of understand it with all of them because they really don't do interviews very often.
Yes.
But as a great tribute to our profession, everybody else, you've read out a long list and there are more, Peter O'Toole, Paul Eddington, Fiona Fullerton, you know, everyone just said yes. And it's yes. Such a tribute to our business that
yes.
All these amazing people were prepared just to turn up. I said, do you want me to arrange a car? No, we'll just arrive. They all just arrived, did the interview and went on to the show that they were doing. I kind of planned it quite carefully so they could literally come to the Young Vic or come to the Playhouse, do the interview and then go straight to the theatre. Yes. And it worked really well.
And by the way, you write a blog attached to the Birmingham Sage Company. I know you know this, but I'm just pointing people to it. You get your most recent blog was very helpful to any actors worrying about auditions. You called it Awful Auditions. And you very helpfully point out that as a producer, you have a problem and you're desperately looking for the actor that next comes through the door to be the one that will solve that problem by being the marvellous person that you've been looking for all this time. And I thought that was a very helpful sort of inverted lens to be more encouraging to actors because we're all terrified of the competition most of the time.
Yeah, everyone thinks they're walking in to be judged and, you know, the interviewer's going, all right, then go on, show me what you've got. But actually, as I say, we're all desperate. We're going, please be the next good actor.
Yes.
Please. And if you get a reaction that feels a bit disconcerting, it's only because the producer is really unhappy and pissed off that you aren't the person that's going to solve their problem for them. So that's why they might be like, okay, thanks very much. It's not because they didn't think you were great. It's just because you weren't what they're looking for.
Yes.
So yeah. But my advice to any actor, any audition is go in to get the job. I made the terrible mistake in my early days of thinking my job as an actor was to go in, present myself and let them make up their minds whether I was right or not. And that is not the way to do it. You go in having done all the work necessary to be basically saying to the producer or director, you ain't going to find anyone better than me for this. I'm the one you've been waiting for. And every time someone has come in who's really prepared it, probably learned the, you know, three or four speeches because they don't know which one's going to come up, and absolutely delivered a lovely performance in that room, we've always cast them. It's never like those sort of people who do that sort of work tend to be the people who get the job.
Yes. Very good and sage advice and very helpful for any actors who will be listening or watching. And by the way, I've just remembered to sort of just complete my story. It was Cal McChrystal who was very kind to furnish me with a warm introduction to Sir Ian McKellen. But I did get that rather, it was very amusing actually when he said, oh, because he was really knackered and leaving stage door at the time. I'd just been at the Ustinov studio doing the most recent live versions of this show as well.
Right.
Anyway, so we're in your country pile in Warwickshire. Very yes. Shakespeare-esque. And so now we're going to arrive with a tree in your clearing. And I love yes. the fact that you always go back to your Warwickshire country pile to feel alive again or to feel... what expression did you use to feel something again, you said?
Well, refreshed, probably.
Yes. So I'm now going to arrive...
It might not be.
I'm going to arrive with a tree in your clearing now, a bit Waiting for Godot-esque, deliberately. I'm going to shake your tree now to see which storytelling apples fall out. How do you like these apples? Comedy clips every now and again, props rather. So now you've been kind enough to prepare your answers to a construct called 54321. 5 minutes to have thought about. Four things that have shaped you, actor manager Neil Foster. Three things that inspire you. Two things that never fail to grab your attention. That's the, oh, squirrels, borrow from the film Up. And then a quirky or unusual fact about you. We couldn't possibly know about you until you tell us. So over to you to interpret the shaking of the canopy of your tree.
Well, I've written them down, because otherwise I wouldn't remember. So I'm going to say there are four things that have shaped me. One of them is that I have a low resting heart rate.
Okay.
Now, very few people know what that is. Even when it's mentioned in medical circles, like when I, you know, proudly tell a doctor, no one really seems to know what it is. But I had one of those epiphany moments when there's a chap who wrote a book about physiological predisposition to criminal behavior. And there are two aspects to predisposition. One is the way the brain functions, and the other one is a low resting heart rate. People whose heart beats slower than average suffer from a lack of fear. They constantly need stimulus because they feel flat all the time. So they're constantly looking for things to keep them interested. Low arousal. In sort of the autistic way, I suppose, in a sense of what it takes to get you to interact.
Yes.
And there's a fourth symptom, which I never remember. But
one would be calm in a crisis with a low heart rate because you're not easily flappable.
That sort of comes under fearless.
Yes. Okay.
And I think that the fact that I constantly need attention and the fact that I lack fear is part of the reason I run a theatre company and part of the reason I could run up to Judi Dench and say, oh, would you let me interview you? That sort of thing. And everything else I've done is because my body functions at a lower rate. So by the time I get excited, I'm probably just barely beating at the same rate as most other people. So that I'm going to give you as my first thing that I think has shaped how my life has unfolded.
And if you're going to the gym,
didn't expect that.
I didn't expect that. And thank you for that curious fact. And just one other question about that. So if you go to the gym to try and do some cardiovascular work, does that mean you've got to sort of pump yourself extra, extra hard in order to get up to other people's rates where they would feel slightly sort of under strain?
Well, I wouldn't know about that. I've never measured my heartbeat, except the only time, I mean, for example, I went in for an operation and the nurse took my pulse and literally began to run out the room calling doctor. And I managed to get her back and I said, what's the point? She said, you're about to crash. Your heart rate's 45 beats. You're about to crash. I said, no, that's me. That's me. She said, what do you mean that's you? I said, that's how it works. My heart beats very. So, you know, in medical terms, I'm nearly dead. And in many other ways.
But you have this is not just blowing some happy smoke at you, but you've got a very good sense of rhythm and energy that's quite frenetic. You're not coming across as somebody who doesn't have, you know, much energy because they've got a low heart rate, for example.
No, but I think we of the low resting heart people that will eventually have our own planet, we're in need of constant stimulation. That's the point. We're constantly, whereas a lot of other people are happy to relax and do nothing, we find it harder because we feel much more sluggish when we're not doing something. It's a weird. And that's why it presupposes criminal behavior, because if you're fearless, you like fear, you have a need for excitement.
Yes.
And low arousal that you don't pick up really on what other people are, the cues from other people. It lends yourself towards it. You also have to have other things. Fortunately, I don't steal much. But
so it gets.
So I move on to my second thing. Am I allowed to move on?
You can. Sorry, I don't mean to be harkening on, and this is the last thing I was going to say about that. It makes you a bit of an adrenaline junkie then, because it disposes.
Yes.
Yes. Number two, please. And I've got a bell, by the way, if we get into rabbit holes. I nearly took us down one there. So
yeah, okay.
That's your number two now, please. So this is the second shapeage.
Well, the second shapeage is my dad, because my dad was an entrepreneur. He was a working class boy born in Streatham and very poor upbringing. Moved from relative to relative because his father couldn't handle him. His mother died when he was two. And he ended up working for his dad in Birmingham in his 20s. I think he had about 8 or 9 jobs over that period, couldn't settle down. I've still got his bus badge. And then he set up he was in tooling. I mean, that's what he was doing for his dad. And he eventually got a job with an engineering company. And And then eventually, when he was 40, set up his own business. And so 40, I'm trying to think how old I was. He had me when he was 44. So by the time I was 10 years old and upwards, he would be telling me stories about how he ran his business. And I think the stories, his confidence in how he did things probably enabled me to run a theatre company because combined with my low resting heart rate and lack of fear, he gave me a sort of bullish quality to it can be done because he'd done it. He was a Tory because he was typical Tory and a self-made man. You know, he'd not been educated. He left school at 14. He was working class. He thought, if I can do it, why, you know, everyone else is a shirker. So he was really one of those people that believe you should just get out and do it. And he wasn't happy when I went out to do acting. I mean, he really wasn't. That was not on the radar at all. But he definitely, I think a lot of my decisions and the way I run my business is based on my dad. So that's a tribute to my father.
Yes. And you did say I've got
Ken Foster.
Ken Foster.
Yeah.
And you mentioned a couple of paragraphs ago, I've still got his bus badge. Just tell me a bit more about that.
Well, he was a coach driver during the war because he had apparently a dodgy heart. They wouldn't let him serve. So he had to drive a bus. And it was a Bedford. And the Bedford buses are what they still drive in Malta. So I bought him a model Bedford when I went to perform in Malta. And I've still got that badge when he was a bus driver.
And did
keeps
he
your
have
feet
a low,
on the ground.
Did he have a low heart rate as well? Your dad?
I don't know.
Oh.
He had a heart that wasn't, they kept telling him he'd had a heart attack or a stroke because the readings were always off. And what it was, we think we found out, eventually he was basically, his heart was in the wrong place. So although his heart was perfectly fine, he lived to 95. Whenever you try to do a reading of his heart, it would always tell them that there was a serious problem. And that's why he wasn't allowed to serve.
Okay.
So that worked well.
His heart was in the wrong place. It was on his sleeve. See what I did there. So shapeage number three, please.
Shapeage is Nat Brenner. I'm going to mention a name that you know.
Yes.
Because Nat Brenner was the principal of the old Bristol-Ovick Theatre School. And then when I joined, it was being run by a wonderful Chris Dennis. And Nat used to come in and do classes. And Nat and I had a love-hate relationship. He couldn't work me out at all. I think we did the show together, Midsummer Night's Dream. Did we do Midsummer Night's Dream together?
We certainly did. Yes, I was.
Well, you might remember when my turn to read Aegeus, and I put on full 30 times hath Phoebus cut, and he said, "What are you doing?
What are you doing?"
I said, "I'm being old." He says, "I'm old. I don't talk like that."
Very good.
But eventually we found a common ground, and he gave me one of the best pieces of advice. One of the best pieces of advice I'd ever had. He said, because I'd already, even while I was at Bristol, I had set up my company, and we were doing shows with the company. And he said, "You're a very clever boy. You're very clever. All your life, they're going to tell you, stop doing the acting and become a producer. They're going to tell you, forget the acting, become a producer. Never let them do it to you. Because that's what happened to me, and I've regretted it my whole life. I should have been an actor. And here I am running a theatre school and a theatre," because he was general manager of, obviously, the Bristol-Ovick. And he said, "Don't let them do it. Never put your name in the programme anything other than an actor." And he was absolutely right. Because acting is such a weird profession, my father, anyone who was successful, would always go, "What are you doing this acting for?
Yes.
You seem quite good at the producing. Just be a producer. There's much more, you know, financial success to be gained from that." It was always great to know that someone who you admired as much as I admired Nat had given me that advice.
Yes.
We
both know this, but he was Peter O'Toole's mentor. Okay, now we're going to talk about three things that inspire you, Neil Foster.
Well, okay, here we go. The reason I have a theatre company, I think partly, is because of Kenneth Branagh. Because I'd had an idea for a theatre company, and like a lot of ideas, you go, "Oh, yeah, that was a good idea," and then you forget about it. And anyway, so Christmas time, we used to have this timeshare, and I was very bored. So I turned on the TV, and Branagh was doing Hamlet in Elsinore. And I thought, I really should get on with this theatre company. I mean, he's doing it. I mean, I know he's Kenneth Branagh. I mean, that's the big difference between me to all the other people you mentioned, Burbage and if we want to say Kevin Spacey or Ken Branagh, who ran their own companies, Peter Anthony Quayle, Olivier, is that they were all very well-known and established in their own rights and before they ran a theatre.
Derek Nimmo as well was one, somebody who was still around when we first graduated. Sorry.
Yeah. But I was and remain really a nobody in terms of, and I'm not a name, you know, no one knows who I am. And that's partly why I thought I can't do this. But watching Kenneth Branagh in, you know, being so successful with Renaissance as it was then.
Yes.
That was an inspiration. So I owe a lot to Ken Branagh. I've never had the opportunity to tell him because he's always too busy to talk to me. But one day I will trip him over and then tell him as I lift him up.
We've got this on. We're recording this as we go. So this will get the extra grist to your mill to be able to get the door open to tell him that, to thank him.
Yes.
Lovely.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And the next one is Richard Dreyfuss. I work with Richard. Richard Dreyfuss, people will know as the American actor who was in Jaws, Close Encounters of the Third Time, The Goodbye Girl, won his Oscar, the youngest male actor to win an Oscar at the time. And I worked with him. He directed my production of Hamlet. And it wasn't fun. And I realized that if it isn't going to be fun, I don't want to do it. So I had to thank Richard for giving me a miserable experience in order to understand that however interesting it is to work with someone as incredible as Richard and to be sold out and all the things that came with working with Richard Dreyfuss, if it wasn't fun, what's the point? And that's also been important to me for the next 30 years.
And have you had the chance to tell him that, even though it's from a dark part?
I wrote a very long letter and he wrote a very long reply. And I thought that was the end of it. And then, this is spookiness for you, particularly as I don't believe in anything. About, I don't know, how old was it? How much later was it? Maybe 6 years later, I was in the office and a fax came through. And it said, "Dear Neil, this is Peter Evans. I'm Richard Dreyfuss's assistant. He is coming to London next week. He would like to invite you for dinner." No, hold on. I've forgotten the point of the story. The point of the story is 2 weeks before this fax came through, I had a dream that I met up with Richard Dreyfuss and we'd had an amazing chat and put everything to bed and become mates. And it was all great. 2 weeks later, this fax came through saying, "Richard would like to invite you for dinner." And I went to this dinner and it literally was my dream because we talked about it. We got on, we went shopping and afterwards and mulled around London. And I met him a couple of times in New York whenever I was over there. He was happy to meet up. And it was just weird that, because I don't believe in things like that. So I don't know how that happened, but I dreamt about something that then happened.
Yes. Wow.
With Richard. One of the things that Richard Dreyfuss said, which is going to bring me to my next inspiration, is that he said that my letter illustrated one of the problems was my inability to talk to Richard when we were doing Hamlet. And I sent it to Paul Scofield, the great actor that people, not everyone knows anymore. Paul Scofield, who was very most famous, much to his chagrin, for Man for All Seasons. But Paul was my patron and was very involved with the company. And I sent him Richard's letter. And his reply was, "I don't know how, as everyone is now aware, having watched this podcast, I don't know how anyone can accuse you of an inability to talk." So... But that brings me to Paul, because Paul is my third inspiration, because Paul Scofield is one of the great men I've met. He really was this fantastic human being, and I was very lucky. He became patron of my company because he worked at the Old Rep in 1944 and obviously went on to great things and is considered to be the greatest Lear that's ever been. And I used to go every year to have tea in their lovely garden and Joy would cook fresh scones, and we sat under the apple trees talking about theatre. And he was just an amazing person to know because of being the sort of human being I hadn't met before. And such a wise, generous, warm, hyper-intelligent, joyous man who did everything he could to help the company. I mean, when we started, he came to see Cat in a Hot Tin Roof and loved it so much. He wrote to, at the time, Richard Eyre at the National saying, "Please give this boy all the help he needs. Anything you could do for Neil would be great." And so consequently, the National Theatre would help us with casting. We got all our props and costumes from the National. Never got charged for any of it because of Paul. So He's looking down at me now from his picture. There's a very severe, dour expression that he has in this picture that I think was his spotlight picture. And I always look at it when I have an idea. I always think, oh, I wonder if we should do that. And I look at Paul's picture and I go, no, Paul's not happy. So it's a very useful picture.
Could you share that picture later on so I can sort of include it? That'd be very exciting.
Yes, I can.
Yes, I can. Lovely, great inspirations. You could be onto a third inspiration now.
Now I've done it. Now I've done it.
Excellent. And now what are your squirrels of distraction? What never fails to grab your attention, irrespective of anything else that's going on for you, Neil Foster?
Well, Russian politics, because my dad, as we've mentioned, was a balloonist and was invited to be one of the first to participate in the first ever balloon fest from Red Square in Moscow. So I went with him. And we were the first people in history to take off from Red Square and fly over the Kremlin, which we weren't supposed to do.
Wow.
But we got pushed by the Italians. No surprise there.
Normally,
and they were going to shoot us down.
The wind that pushes you, but the Italians push you. You're blaming the Italians.
It was the Italians. All the other balloons went that way, and we ended up going over the Kremlin. And literally, they were going to shoot us down because no one is allowed to fly over the Kremlin.
Yeah.
We did. I've got lots of pictures. And our order to takeoff was signed by Gorbachev and Yeltsin because it was just after the attempted coup against Gorbachev when Yeltsin had stood on the tank. So just before I went to Russia, I'd watched Brooke Lapping's amazing documentary, The Second Revolution, all about Gorbachev. And I understood after that Russian politics better than some of the Russians that I met. I mean, it was such a brilliant documentary that I've been fascinated by Russian politics ever since. So that anything to do with Russia.
And
I mean, fortunately, there's nothing going on.
You've had a unique view of Russian politics because you've been flying in a hot air balloon. I love the fact, you know, mostly it's we blame the Russians as the stereotype, but you're blaming the Italians for blowing you over the Russians. Not bad.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
That's a great squirrel. No one's ever answered the squirrel thing with that degree of intellect. I love that.
Really?
Very good.
Gosh, that surprises me.
Second squirrel.
And the other thing is politics. I am very interested in politics. I don't know why, but if I had been a betting man, I wouldn't need to talk to you now because I'd be living in my Miami estate with 7,000 servants because I correctly predicted, without putting money on it, that Blair would win 3 elections and that the 4th election would be interesting, which was, of course, the coalition. This had never happened in history before. Labour had only ever won 2 consecutive elections. They'd never won 3. But I was convinced that when Blair came in, well, before Blair got elected, that he was going to win the next 3 elections. And if I'd have put money on that, I would be wealthy.
And have you met Tony Blair to tell him that you now wish you'd put money on him?
I met him on the tube prior to him becoming Labour leader. And I thought, you're going to be Labour leader. And we chatted a little bit. And I also met Ed Miliband on a tube, but I didn't talk to him. Actually, my funny story about Ed Miliband is I got into a big row in Marks & Spencer's over a refund that went on and on and on to this really horrific manager of the store in South Hampstead. And I was having a row for about 15 minutes. I mean, the security guard was trying to get rid of me. They were going to call the police. And the entire time while I was rowing, like, what the hell? Ed Miliband was standing next to me trying to click and collect.
Trying to,
because the machine wasn't working.
He was trying to find his
so
own.
So he just stood there looking, just kept looking. And I'd look at him. And eventually I said, could someone please serve Mr. Miliband? This is ridiculous. So, and I once stood next to William Hague in a toilet. So these are all seminal moments in any political analyst's life.
Excellent. And did you ever win your argument with M&S, or to this day you're unsatisfied?
I can't remember because Ed Miliband kind of took the attention.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Start your day the right way with Revive Active's range of super supplements and get the most out of life. Take one power-packed sachet mixed with water and enjoy a super tasty health drink at work, at home or on the go. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to optimize your health and well-being to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health and more. No filler, no stimulants, no artificial colors or preservatives. Just the right mix of vitamins, minerals, amino acids, and hero ingredients to help you put back what life takes out. Try our 7-day or 30-day boxes and use code UKRADIO to get a free supplement shaker. Revive Active. Super supplements for a super you.
Nature's Medicine for Modern Living. A people and plants dialogue hosted by Sophie.Health. At Sophie, we bring together experts and voices who rarely cross paths. Our quest is to illuminate the ancient world of plant medicine and reimagine it for the connected age. Join us to explore new boundaries of digital personalized medicine with deep roots in the natural world. And hear from our community of international pioneers who are validating this new paradigm and improving how we feel, sleep, and cope with daily stresses naturally. Sophie.Health, reconnecting people and plants.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Great squirrels. Now, a quirky or unusual fact about you we couldn't possibly know about you until you tell us.
My dad had a very good wine collection, and I understood nothing about wine. And one New Year's Eve, I was going to a party, so I thought, oh, Dad's got champagne. So I went down into his cellar and took three bottles of 1976 Krug, the best vintage of Krug, apparently, of the last century. I never told him that I turned one of them into Buck's Fizz. I think I gave one bottle to a woman I was attracted to at that party, and we drank the other. Now, my dad, who could never remember anything, I mean, my dad lost his memory, you know, couldn't remember, never, ever forgot that I had taken his three favorite bottles of 1976 Krug champagne.
And so what are we talking about? The retail value of a Krug bottle of champagne, what are we talking?
Well, I should think at the time, it was probably 50 quid, but I'm talking about 40 years ago.
Yes.
So we're going to be talking about probably 200, 250 quid a bottle now.
Wow. I'm quite tempted to invite you to a party to see what grog you turned up with. Fantastic. That's a great fact. Thank you.
Well, it's okay. A fact.
We've shaken your tree. Now we're staying in the clearing, moving away from the tree, and we're talking about alchemy and gold now. So Neil Foster, Hector Manager, when you're at purpose and in flow, what are you absolutely happiest doing and what you're here to reveal to the world?
Acting. That's all I like doing. Not all I like doing, but it's the major thing I like doing a lot. And still people don't get it. I mean, literally, even a couple of days ago, someone was saying to me, really, it's the acting you still like. It's like, yes.
Yes.
As you mentioned, very kindly, we did this prom at the Royal Albert Hall, which you can still watch on iPlayer. And, you know, performing in front of 5,000 people at the Royal Albert Hall with an orchestra and a chorus and some of the best actors I've ever worked with on stage and six opera singers, not a great moment to forget your lines, I have to add. I had been warned that don't worry if you forget your lines because there's an auto prompt on the stage. Yeah, great. Of course, when I forgot my line, it went off. So I had to actually remember my line, which was trickier than just looking at it. But, you know, that was one of the great experiences of my life. So, yep, I'm happiest when I'm in front of an audience trying to entertain them.
And presumably that gets your low resting heart rate up in the right way.
I have never been so frightened because we had very little rehearsal time. If I put it this way, we performed in front of, you know, so we're in, live in front of 5,000 people, live on Radio 3. It's being filmed for CBBC. We had one run through.
Wow.
You know, it was ludicrous. I have never been so. So I think my heart rate would probably have gone through the roof for that show. But it was still.
Because your through the roof heart rate is probably just, can I be bothered for other
58.
People?
Yeah.
Okay, so now I'm going to award you with a cake. Hurrah! This is the last sort of multi-layered sort of element of story-suffused brilliance. So you get to put a cherry on the cake now. First of all, do you like cake, Neil Foster?
Yes.
Which cake would you like, please? It's a metaphorical cake.
Well, anyone who knows Maison Berthoux in Greek Street, run by Michelle Wade, will know she does the best cakes, and I like her cream fruit eclair. And if I don't get it, I'm going to be unhappy.
Cream.
It's only about £5, so I think you can stump to that. Maison Berthoux, Greek Street.
Maison
I want it.
Berthoux.
It's Bertaux. Anyone wants a really wonderful cake and cup of tea, you won't get anywhere better. It's not cheap, but it's very good.
I'm going to look that up. Greek Street, did you say?
Yeah, no. It's the best. Yes. It's like a little old French. She runs it like a little old French patisserie.
What's
it's
her name
sensational.
Again? Michelle who?
Michelle Wade, who I did The Seagull with, one of my first shows at the Birmingham Rep, where we performed at the Birmingham Rep. She was a very brilliant masher.
Lovely. What goes around comes around. She's supplying you with chocolate eclairs with creme fruit on them. Awesome.
Not for free. I have to pay a lot.
I'll see if I can have one shipped here. Anyway, you now get to put a cherry on your cake. You've got enough fruit in it already by the sound of it. But this is now stuff like, what's a favourite inspirational quote, Neil, that's always given you succour and pulled you towards your future?
Well, Obama had it after me, but there's a few quotes. I like "It can be done." I do think that's important. But my quote that I use most often to calm myself down, and I use it a lot, it's really a mantra rather than a quote, and it's my own creation, is "No wish for, no worry." No wish for it to be any different than it is today. It's a bit zen-y, I suppose, a bit zen. And no worry about the future. Just try and live in the moment. So I say to myself, no wish for, no worry.
Just unpack the no wish for bit again. Is that, I mean, don't...
No wish for it to be any different than it is at this moment. Don't, because it's a pointless exercise. Like, you can't get ahead of yourself until you've made the mistakes, until you've mucked up. You don't know. So don't beat yourself up. Don't wish for it to be any different. You got here. If you're still here, then you've done better than people like some, you know, very close friends who are not here anymore. No wish for it to be any different than it is. And don't worry about the future, because the future is a fantasy.
Lovely. Very nicely unpacked. What notes, help or advice might you proffer to a younger version of yourself with the gift of hindsight?
I've got to say it probably because it's sort of been a hallmark of mine, is just to do it. There's a wonderful quote by Goethe where he talks about the genius of any action in life and any activity is to start it.
Yes.
The first step's the most important, because whatever dream you had, what you never can take into account is the role that Providence is going to play. Because if you've had a good idea, I think it has to be a good idea. If you've had a good idea, all sorts of things will happen. As he said, sort of all manner of positive outcomes, all manner of things will help you achieve what you're seeking to do. But the crucial thing, what is boldness has genius, begin it now, is kind of the thing. So I would just say to anyone who's thinking about doing something, this includes me, obviously, who's been trying to write a play for 8 years, begin it now. Begin it now. Don't wait, because you just don't know how long you've got, and you can waste time.
Beautifully put and very, very relatable. Love that. What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
I think I'm sorry to be repetitive. I think Nat Brenner's advice, just to hark back to that, was the best bit of advice, because it kept me on the road. Because
the advice about being an actor, not being a manager.
Being an actor, but do what you want to. I think the real problem for a lot of people in this world is they end up doing what they're good at.
Yeah.
Now, that would seem like a good idea, to do what you're good at, but sometimes what you're good at is not really what you want to do. It just happens you've got a natural ability for it, but it might not be what ticks your box, what really fulfills your dream. And I think the most important thing is to do what you love, not what you're good at. Obviously, it helps to have a house and the ability to afford food and heating, but doing what you love will tend to probably produce more success anyway, because you will give everything to it. If you love it, you will devote your whole life to it. And I just think sometimes doing what you're good at is not the best route to a happy life.
And with your own equation and formula, the fact that you've straddled both actor manager with the wonderful sort of legacy of that, going back to Sir Richard Burbage et al., is the idea that you've actually, you've got both going on. You've found the perfect way of navigating that. Because yes, you're a manager, but you still, you're going to be the main part all next year. I commend you.
Yes, sir. What was the question? Was it a statement or a question?
I was just affirming that I understood, but I'm noticing that you've actually nailed it for yourself, because you're actually doing both. You haven't just sat on one side of the fence. It hasn't. You're actually straddling both by being an actor manager, and I commend you for that.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so we're ramping up to a bit of Shakespeare in a minute, borrowed from the All the World's a Stage and All the Men and Women Pinny Players. Just before we do that, this is the Pass the Golden Baton moment, please. So who would you most like, having experienced this from within, to pass the golden baton along to in order to keep the golden thread of storytelling going?
Well, I would like to pass it on to Richard J. Hines, who is my movement director on my production of Orfalante, was movement director on my production of Demon Dentist. He's just choreographed Elf at the Dominion. He's a new addition to the team of Birmingham Stage Company. I met him for Demon Dentist. And I'm doing this for very selfish reasons, because I'd like to know the answer to all these questions that Richard, because I find him, he's great. It was Robert Hands, who is a fellow colleague of us from
who's guesting soon, by the way. He's guesting beginning of January.
Right. Well, he recommended him. I asked Robert, what do you think of Richard? Because he was also a sister choreographer on Come From Away.
Yeah.
And Robert said, if you can get him, get him. He's the adult in the room. And so it's turned out to be. He's a really great addition to us. Everyone really appreciates what he does. I'm also made him assistant director on Orfalante. I'd be fascinated to hear much more about his life and what motivates him. And I pass the baton on to him.
Richard J. Hines, thank you very much. Okay, now, inspired by Shakespeare, by the way, this is the actual, not the first folio, but this is the book I bought when I went to the Bristol Vic Theatre School. It says a date you relate to, 16th of the 9th, 86. Thank you. But anyway, inspired by All the World's a Stage and All the Men and Women Merely Players, Neil Foster, Hector Manager, how, when all is said and done, would you most like to be remembered?
I don't care.
Boom.
Because I'll be dead.
Double boom. Excellent. And now, where can we find out all about you on the old hinterweb?
Oh, well, it's called thebirminghamstage.com. That's where it is. Birminghamstage1word.com is our website. And you'll find everything we're doing on that.
So thank you to my esteemed guest, Neil Foster, Hector Manager. I've been Chris Grimes. This has been the Good Listening to Show.com. Check out the various series strands if you too would like to be my guest too. Don't forget there's also a series strand called Legacy Life Reflections, where you can lend the structure or the construct of the show to record the story of someone near, dear or close to you for posterity. That's just one of several series strands you can check out at thegoodlistening2show.com. I've been Chris Grimes, that was Neil Foster. Tune in next time for more stories from the clearing, and goodbye. You've been listening to The Good Listening To Show here on UK Health Radio with me, Chris Grimes. Oh, it's my son.
If you've enjoyed the show, then please do tune in next week to listen to more stories from the clearing.
If you'd like to connect with me on LinkedIn, then please do so. There's also a dedicated Facebook group for the show too. You can contact me about the programme, or if you'd be interested in experiencing some personal impact coaching with me, care of my Level Up Your Impact programme, that's chris@secondcurve.uk. On Twitter and Instagram, it's
@thatchrisgrimes.
So until next time, for me, Chris Grimes, from UK Health Radio, and from Stan,
to your good health.
And goodbye. So, Neil Foster, you've just been given a damn good listening to in the show. Could I just get your immediate feedback on what that was like being curated through this journey in this formula?
I enjoyed it because it reminded me of all sorts of wonderful people who, although are very present in my life, I don't get to talk about Nat Brenner very often, or Richard Dreyfuss, or Paul Scofield, or my dad in that quite the way. So that it's been a great joy to remind myself of the wonderful people who've been in my life.